Succession number 19922, Reel 5.
Barry Smith, Reel 5.
I suppose the job that we were doing would be considered to be quite a dangerous operation, going out in ones and twos. Twos, if you're lucky, as I've said before, and you could be under fire while you're out there all of a sudden. Shell fire, mortar fire, or run into Chinese patrols who were seeking patrols that would go out the same as we would. And it was really, I suppose, in working in the dark, especially at night, as you would never go out in the daytime into the forward positions laying lines. I have done, but we don't. It wasn't the normal practice. But obviously, you'd be seen by the enemy, and they would open up with mortars or what have you, strafing fire, just to keep your head down.
You were telling me earlier, off the record, something which was of interest to me about the policy of the British Army of economising with soldiers' lives.
Yes, I don't think I'm going to say anything that is not already known, but officers in charge would not squander their men in silly operations. They were normally very well thought out. The communications, being a signaler, you'd be privy to all this information. That's why my memory is not bad on certain things. All this information passes through you, even if it doesn't affect you personally. Tended to have it very well organised. The idea was not to waste men's lives. The idea was to effect an operation and return all to base without any casualties. Whereas the Chinese, if, for example, they were to attack, as they did on a number of occasions, they would lay up on the barbed wire at night, coming through the minefield, and just lay up on the barbed wire, unbeknown to you in the darkness. They were quite silent at night as soldiers. And then suddenly, in the early hours of the morning, they'd come over the top of the forward positions. This happened to a number of regiments, and it's well documented. But they had no fear, appeared to have no fear of for their lives, as opposed to ourselves. I think everyone has fear. If you didn't, you wouldn't be normal. In fact, fear is what makes you do your job more efficiently. You've been taught well, and it tends to gird you on in that sense. And many books have been written on the subject, no doubt, about my feelings I've just quoted. But the Chinese would, a Chinese company, say our company was, say, about 100, which is about right, the Chinese company would be treble that amount. So if they attacked, if you had a company attacked by Chinese, you were, it's about 4 to 1. So the British soldier was expected to, we weren't there in large numbers, so we were expected to be, not to be wasteful with our lives or to carry out our jobs efficiently. And we would, our manning of the lines was quite sparse. But I do feel it was very efficient. If it hadn't have been so, we would have lost many more men than we did.
What about the other allies which you had on the UN side in Korea?
Yeah,
were they similarly careful about not squandering the lives of their
soldiers? They must have all had similar mandates. The Americans, this is not a criticism, although there's a lot been written on the subject and said about some. The Americans would, they had a hill down the line called Old Baldy, and this was a bit of a hot spot. The same as our hot spot was the Hook. The Hook was a well-known part in the line, very exposed forward positions. I've been up to this particular place on a number of occasions, but I'll get to that. They would go out and rattle up the enemy and generally have a dust up, and they would lose a lot more men than us, or get themselves into trouble, as I say, more than us, because they weren't, I would say, not as good soldiers or not so well trained. People would criticise me on this for this particular remark, but the Australians, we would get them on the same brain network as ourselves. On one occasion, I was listening in, and we had to listen to all traffic on the radio, especially if it may well be of importance to us, and report accordingly to the officers. But on one particular occasion, there was obviously an American patrol out, and he got himself into a lot of trouble. And I heard this message on the radio, and I immediately communicated with one of the other signallers, which is on the Australian regiment, which is on the same network. And he came back to me in his typical Australian way, he was talking, in the way they talk. And he said, yeah, he said, we've got it all covered. He said, we've sent some people out there to get them in. He said, saying so many words, he said that they used to go out, get themselves in trouble. And the Australians who were in their sector had to go out and get them out of trouble. I've been told that by people that were in Korea in earlier on in the war, that in the case of the Gloucesters, this is well documented, incidentally, that the Americans who were on the flanking hills had a Chinese attack. Involved in a firefight with the Chinese. They then decided that they would just leave the sector and get out. And the Gloucesters, who were on a position in the valley, in between, were in fact supposed to have been in reserve. I may be misquoting this particular event. And the Americans had buggered off, in so many words, to use army language. And the Chinese merely came straight down through between the two hills. And this glorious action that the Gloucesters fought, wonderful though it was, they had no option, because the Chinese had no... the Americans had left the Gloucesters in the lurch, as it were.
Can you check the...
There's various versions of that, but that was the feelings people had about the Americans as to their reliability.
Now, you described to me your memories of Pimlico. Can you tell me what happened to you after that, please?
Well, after Pimlico, there was... after Pimlico, we... my mind gets a bit hazy of events. We're going back a long time, it's over 50 years, nearly 50 years. And there was various... I was transferred to other companies in the line where they needed qualified signallers. And there was one particular hill. I've got the number of the hill somewhere up in my papers. But this particular hill down one side was very open to view by the Chinese, and they would show this this particular area. I think it was called Mad Alley. And they had netting on large poles all down one side to as camouflage. And our particular regiment was there, well, the company was there at that time. And I can't remember if this is before or just after Pimlico. I've got a feeling it's just after Pimlico, if I remember rightly, because I was transferred to another company after that. In the early hours of the morning, the signals jeep, Royal Signals jeep, rather Royal Signals, or one of them may have been Royal Signals jeep, came up to the along this road to supply us, that's the signalers, my company officers and ourselves, with the new codes. The codes that we use, this schematic, was it could be changed at any moment, sometimes three or four times, or twice a night, or at certain periods during the day. It depended on how they viewed the security of the situation, whether they changed the codes twice or more times in a day. And this was the delivery of the new codes to be used for the following 48 hours or what have you. And the jeep, on approaching the rear positions, we had a Browning machine gun facing to our rear with one particular fusilier mounting it. And it was, as I say, in my previous conversation on this tape about how the Chinese would infiltrate your rear if you weren't careful, and the minefield. He saw this movement coming down the road and was unaware that there would be a signal jeep approaching. He then proceeded to open up with the Browning gun, shooting this jeep up. The two men in it immediately came under fire, got out the jeep and got cover. In other words, he shot up the jeep, which was the Don R Signals jeep bringing the new codes. He was very quickly taken off the gun. This might be taken as funny by some other fusiliers. This is not a criticism of the fusilier who opened up. Just to explain to you, or trying to demonstrate, the situation is that you might be nervous on a gun, knowing there's movement at night, and you hadn't got time to make a snap judgment. If Chinese approached, you opened up. This brings me to the codes that we would use. The code for, say, 12 hours would be when someone was challenged by a sentry to the rear of the hill or to others approaching the flanks from other companies. You would be challenged and they say, halt. Not who goes there, traditional army things, but they say, halt. And they would say, honey. Now, the code would be in two parts, like the American parlance. Honey bee, honey child, honey lamb, something like that. And they say, halt. And the reply should be, honey. Then you could approach closer, and then you could pass through the lines. Because the Chinese used to infiltrate the lines, if you were challenged after three times, you didn't give the right answer back. The mandate was that you would then immediately start firing. This obviously made people nervous, or could have done, made people nervous of figures in the dark sort of thing, you know, because as I say, the Chinese, once they were upon you, it was once they got into your positions, you were in deep trouble. As I say, they would attack en masse, even in smaller bands, and very fearless in that sense. So this brings me to the backtrack about laying lines. We were laying a line to C Company. I mentioned this company I think the hill was 227 John we were on, and laying a line to the C Company that had been blown, working our way along. And incidentally, to digress, the field telephone, as I mentioned earlier on, that was cumbersome in the field, this, by this time, after several using it for some considerable time, was ditched. And we made up our own microphones. This was made out of spare equipment. And we used to get old, we used to get small boxes. I can draw it. I can draw it on a bit of paper for you right now. Snap lock padded boxes for spare radio valves, which we would keep, because we had the sets in those days in the bungalows, the big transmitters, where if you had a valve go, you could replace the valves, like in the old-fashioned radio sets. Nowadays, it's all transistors. you come forward 50 years. And we know how to do basic repairs on radio sets should the occasion arise, God help us. But sometimes you had a valve blow, and if it was anything really, really serious, you'd have to replace a whole set, obviously, or they'd replace it. We would make up these boxes by a small battery and wiring. I can't exactly tell you how we would do it now without consulting the electronics manual, but with a microphone and like a handset, as it were, from a normal telephone, these would be portions would be cut out of the box, and from the box there would be a hole drilled in the side, and out of the box would come these two cables which were joined together, and in the end taped by insulation tape was merely a pin. This pin was then just put through the line, and if the line was good, this is when you used to test back to, you had to test back to you had to test back to your headquarter company module, you know, the they call it the telephone exchange that we had. Either test to the other company, your company, you'd find out by trial and error, as it were. You've got a good knack of doing this, especially at night, feeling the lines. Many lines have been blown and discarded because of shell fire, and the knack was to find the right one. Most of your lines were buried in the side of the trenches or in undergrowth as best you could. But constantly being blown, obviously. But we test back. We merely pushed the wire, the pin, through the line. This would drop the bird's eye, the little shutter at the other end. You didn't have to ring. Totally silent. It was very portable and quarter the size of the army issue set. And this is not well known, but this is how we used to do it. Also, line equipment. We carry our pliers and our various line man's repair equipment, insulation tape, etc. Apart from all your armament, you know, your armaments, what have you. And you would... can we stop here? Yes, so we would test back in this method. As I say, I digress there for a minute, and I'm now back on the subject. The spare line that we would carry, we used to have frames which would fit on your back like a haversack, and it was mounted the line layer. You'd put the reel in the back, and you'd run out or march out with this line down the trenches. In our case, especially at daylight, we would tear down these trenches as quick as possible, laying a line and securing it, tying it off at various junctures in and around the trenches. And we didn't bother with the, we used the new plastic lines that are then being issued, not the traditional ones, which were quicker to repair and easier to lay. It's like the modern wiring you now see now, thin black plastic wiring. And quite cheap, I suppose, to if you wasted any, there's plenty of it. We put our arm through the, or have a stick and put it through the middle of the reel, and rather than carry a harness, we'd run it out that way, by hand, much quicker, much more silent, and less equipment. Anyway, we were approaching as a C company, and while you're out, the codes have been changed. I referred to codes before. And on approaching in darkness, the flanking company, we were duly challenged. Now, they may be well aware that signalers would be approaching to reinstate the line, but no chances were taken, and they were immediately challenged by the forward position guards or flanking guards. And halt, and we said, I don't know what I said, or we said, honey. And no, to go retrace, they would say, halt, honey. And we said, B. And the code had been changed to honey, child. Now, I can't exactly the exact words, but it was definitely along these lines. Immediately, you could hear all the bolts go. Slammed home in the rifles, and the unmistakable Bren gun being cocked, and it's well known to you the sound. It travels at night anyhow. And immediately they were asked the second time. As I said, the third time they were open up. Now we knew this, and we said it again, and obviously it was wrong. It was only at the intervention of the Sergeant Major, who immediately, sensing there was some problem on the forward positions, immediately came to the fore, and in the gloom recognised us that we were sensing, he would know this, that they were approaching signalers. Now, I don't, the feeling that I had, as I've had on many occasions, when laying lines, you might say the feeling that all hell was going to let loose any minute and you'd be killed, badly wounded, or it was almost a feeling, the fear of the unknown, that anything could happen at any minute, at any given second at night, that in many ways was more frightening than actually being under an existing barrage, because any minute something could happen. If it didn't, but you might say, it sounds a bit exaggerated, to say your heart jumped and you could die a thousand deaths, as it were. That feeling of, oh my God, you know. But we were trained, well trained. Thank God, as I'm able to say, I'm still here. And I think if we weren't well trained, we would have come a cropper. But I think...
You were telling me earlier about Hill
255. Yeah, I can tell you all these hills. I've got them all up on stairs in my papers, but it's also in the archives. 227 John, I think it's called. Well-known position.
The hill was called John?
John, yeah. 227 John.
But you were telling me earlier about some of your experiences on it.
Yeah, yes. Well... Well, right, this last thing about approaching flanking position, this was just one of the many things that you had to contend with as a signaller. And I have been out in a minefield at night, for example, and flares would go up quite regularly. This is common, flares would go up, illuminating the whole of the landscape. We have been taught in basic training that if you were standing and a flare went up, you merely didn't move. Now, this is very hard to do, not to move. Immediately, one of you is crouching down, repairing a line, and the other one of you is standing guard, as it were, at night. It's very much worked between you two of you like that. One of them keep an eye open, and the other would go about repairing the line. Anyone about, obviously, you, if you're doing a job, you can't concentrate on anything else that's going to happen outside your parameter, as it were. At any rate, helping each other. We very much were like that, working silently together. We know exactly what to do, and we'd work together like it was almost like clockwork, as you might say. But well trained. Thank God. The flares would go up, and we were. This goes to retrace that we used to work out in the open at night, and we were being taught in basic training that if that happened to you, stand dead still and look down, because a person's face illuminated to a flare at night, looking up or forward, can be seen quite vividly at a distance. So you look down and you stay there. Now, while the flare is burning, one felt very vulnerable. And this is a feeling I can't really impart in words. It's you're standing there and you're expecting any minute to be hit by something or something to happen. And then eventually the flare goes out. And obviously, you don't stand there anymore, you get your head down. But I mean, you can be caught in an upright position in those circumstances. And this, the fear or the feeling that you get of being quite alone or vulnerable other Korean veterans have mentioned this, about being very sort of, although you were with your colleagues, you felt quite alone on many occasions. It's just a feeling of, it's very hard to impart into words, I can feel it, but you know, you've got to be a very good linguist to try and put it over to some people, so they grasp what you're trying to get at.
It's a sense of terror, is it?
Yes, fear, I'd say. I think we weren't afraid in that sense. I think a fear of the unknown is always worse than the fear of it actually happening. It's hard to explain. It hits us all. I don't think to say that you had no fear would be wrong. I'm speaking as an ex-fireman as well. We all know fear, but I think that's what drives you to do the job efficiently. If you have no fear, you're going to put yourself. If you have a stupid and have no respect of fear, as it were, you could put yourself and your colleagues in a dangerous position. To explain that in a roundabout way.
Can you tell me what happened in the chronology? What happened next to you?
Well, there are lots of other events like this. These events that I'm quoting happen quite regularly, and they pull into insignificance, really, I suppose, because it was a job which we just went out and did. We expected to do it, and you did it. And if you did it well, you knew that you'd probably come back alive, or you'd... you'd get through your stint in the line, and you didn't want to let the side down, what have you. As I say, we're small in numbers, so every man was expected to do his task to his utmost. You had the feeling, of course, all British soldiers may have quoted this one, that being well trained, you thought you were sort of not bulletproof, but you would